episode of the Australian Baby Boomer podcast. Today's episode is the second half of an interview with Dr. Jannie Lloyd, who has been researching healthy longevity for the last 30 years. In this episode, Jannie uses her speculative fiction book, which explores the possibility of healthy life extension, and we discuss the implications, the social implications of people living longer. Please enjoy.
Yeah, it's about the discussion now with Kevin, isn't it?
Both Tina and the manager, Robert, told Lynn and Tom how much they also got from what they shared. Robert said that he and some other hostel managers in the area were going to begin talks soon about the possibility of a government-employed social worker to assist with people's transition back into the wider community. So this is an interesting idea, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
The whole idea of moving out of assisted living back into the community.
So yes, it is. Yeah.
Talk a bit about that.
Yeah. It's that thing that if this, obviously, the desired point of intervention at this time is to get some sort of course teaching these foundation stones running for people to understand and learn before they're in any sort of care situation.
Yes.
You know, that they're fully independent so that they're maintaining their health and none of this is required. However, so this is our one man who has been in hostel care for a few years, but he's now doing the regeneration regime and having really good effects from it. And so in a few months, they're saying he's going to be ready to go back out into the world. So his family have been living in his house, so they've had to then start talking with Kevin about how that's actually going to unfold and what it will mean to the family and so on. And we'll probably get onto some of that later on. But he has really good family support, Kevin, and that will be demonstrated in future episodes. But a lot of people, of course, don't have that community and family support. So the hostel and the government are going to have to think about having social workers to actually assist and the people to put everything into place to make that move. And that in itself will be an interesting move for the people because that place, that hostel is now their home. That's their environment. They've made their friends there. Mm. So it would have to be a stepwise process of actually starting to join some groups back out into the community, finding accommodation, working out all of those, the nitty-gritty of how do you plug back in to the community. And it will be quite a slow process once again. None of this will be, I don't think any of this, even if there was some major breakthrough scientific, I don't think any of it is going to be an overnight thing. And in fact, how would we deal with it as a society if it was?
Well, that's right. But I think also that move back into community has already been done with disability services. So this is really taking another step and saying, well, with aged care services, there's a
that's
the potential
right.
if people regain health that they will be able to move into a more community-based situation.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thought too because sometimes it might be that they'll need to go into a house that has maybe two or three people in there that
like
doesn't
a group home,
a group home yeah, yes. where they're actually independent but they're not fully in their own home or so there could be even those sorts of stepwise
processes.
Well,
I often think that would be a better thing for
it
right now
could.
Anyway. You
could
know,
be, could
because,
be.
Because it's more like...
Yeah, and that will be very individually you know, as always, it will depend on the individual and their own community supports and all of this and all their needs and what they want, you know. Yeah, we're incredibly interesting, complex beings, aren't we?
So we'll read a bit more about Kevin. Kevin has been on the regeneration program for over a year now, and he's probably only a few months away from re-entering the wider community, said Tina. How does that feel, Kevin? Inquired Lynn. Bit weird, actually, said Kevin. This place has been mostly my world for almost 3 years. They were interrupted by people arriving with plates of food and offers of tea and coffee. Tom said to Kevin, let's have some of these refreshments and then we can go somewhere quieter and chat. They all mingled for a while. Some had a few questions that they didn't want to ask in front of everyone. It wasn't long, though, before people began to leave. Tina thanked everyone involved and took her leave. And soon it was just Kevin, Lynn, Tom and a few staff members. Kevin walked Tom and Lynn outside to a quiet and secluded part of the garden. The nature there was lovely. And Kevin said that was where he did most of his meditation and breathing. He remarked on how much he enjoyed the mindful presence that had developed within him. Kevin shared that it was so wonderful to hear their stories today, and he wondered if they could connect again, as he had a lot to share with them too. Yes, we'd love to hear what has been unfolding for you, Tom. Tom smiled, adding that life usually made sure that no one's experience was exactly the same. They shared the quiet presence of the now for a while, watching some of the silver eyes flying amongst the trees. How does next Wednesday about 10 sound to you? Sounds great, said Kevin, waving to them both as they made their way towards the car park. So that's, you know, this whole thing of meditation, mindfulness, being in nature, this is a part of the equation as well, an important part of actually enabling the body to, I guess, rest so that it can do its thing.
It's once again, it just brings in an incredible shift in consciousness, actually being more present to life in the moment. And your brain functioning alters. We know from neuroscience now that there's all sorts of brainwave pattern shifts with meditation. We tend to go more into that space of, I suppose some spiritual and mystic people have called it the unified field. And it offers a sense of relaxation within the body that brings us into that parasympathetic nervous system and allows all that lovely regenerative thing to occur, and it takes us out of the inflammation. So, yeah, Kevin's learnt that skill now, and, that's one of the things that they share.
Inflammation is one of the big problems as we get older, isn't it? So could you maybe talk a bit more about how inflammation impacts the body?
Yeah, it impacts us in every possible way. We produce all these stress hormones. The sympathetic nervous system is some of that energy is a positive thing, not the inflammatory part of it, but the sympathetic nervous system does have, and those sorts of chemicals do actually assist us to run and dance, and you know, they give us that more vigorous activity and so on. Obviously, the blood pressure goes up a little bit to facilitate more muscle, you know, blood flow and all of those, so obviously it has a place in our body, otherwise it wouldn't be there. But if it goes into overdrive via stress, then it actually causes our cells to deteriorate and become inflamed, the telomere length reduces, all of these things occur, and that causes old cell debris, it causes fibrosis and inflammation. Mm. So there's multiple consequences to prolonged inflammation of the body. Yes. And many disease processes are linked with that. And the other thing for people to be aware who aren't medically trained, because I keep forgetting people don't know all this stuff.
Yes, that's right.
Sometimes you assume everybody knows this stuff.
That's right.
But so many disease processes are actually secondary to the effects of aging.
Mm.
You know, so as a medical student, you know, one of the first things you would cite as a risk factor of whatever disease process you were talking about was aging.
Yes.
You know, it was like the number one risk factor. So all of these inflammatory processes actually make any disease more likely to occur.
Yeah.
So people have to understand that, and that's why doing these processes for people that have only been here 20 years is going to benefit the health of everybody. And you know, so it's, that doesn't just start as seniors. So yeah, the inflammatory process, and so the body then in its regeneration process has to try and then work to get rid of all this cellular debris, all of this thing that isn't working properly in the body. So it's actually then having to be in overdrive itself.
Right.
To make, and so, it, yeah, that's what happens if we're not doing all these. I suppose you could, I mean, I don't ever like to use a car analogy for the body because I see us much more as a living ecosystem that's continually growing and changing and regenerating. However, I will use the car analogy here.
Yes.
And the car analogy is, if you drove your car with one foot on the brake and one foot on the accelerator and you were not putting oil in your car and you were just over revving it all the time, and your car would not last very long.
Mm.
And so that's a little scenario for if you're in overdrive with stress all the time, that's what you're actually doing partly to your mechanism, to your body. Even though, as I say, it's more a living ecosystem, you can use that. So how you dry or how you look after and be with your body and listen to it and work with it and use these foundation stones, that often dictates what it's doing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, so if you drove your car like that, you'd be at the mechanic every week and you'd be, yeah, it would not last.
I think you've been watching how I drive my car. No, that's. I think it's a useful analogy, even though the body is definitely it's a
not
much
a machine.
More of a, no, it's not a machine. It's something which, and that's the whole point, I guess, of this regeneration potential is that it isn't a mechanistic thing. It's not something.
It does have mechanistic components to it. There's no doubt, but overall, we've got too much into that analogy, and it's not good.
Yeah. Great. So, which area do you think we should focus on next?
I think, can we go to the next episode?
So we've got part 12 here.
Yeah. If we go to the discussion in the coffee shop, I think that might be of some value.
Okay. So we've got Kevin talking about his, they're going to have some coffee together. So, and Kevin's coming along here, so. Tom and Kevin ordered their favourites while Lynn found a table near a small garden with a little fountain. On the way there, Kevin had told them that he'd mostly worked in the building trade and in the previous couple of decades ran his own handyman business. When they got settled with their coffee and snacks, Kevin continued, "I reached the point of requiring hostel care accommodation about 3 years ago. My son and daughter-in-law moved into my house, so when I decided to do the regeneration regime, we needed to talk about what we would do about accommodation in the future. We'd all thought that the former house of mine would become their home and their future children's home. They've now found a newer suburb only 20 minutes away where they can get a place at a much lower rent And once their savings reach a reasonable level, they'll be able to buy there. That's good. What are you going to do with the gardening, cooking and cleaning when you move back into your home? Asked Tom. That will be in just a few months now, won't it? Yes, I know I'll miss some of my friends at the hostel. However, I can visit them. With the gardening, I'm going to get someone once a month. I've always loved cooking and am looking forward to doing some of those vegetarian vegan recipes. I've been asking the cook at the hostel for the recipes of my favourite dishes. I can see why Tina and Robert were saying about having a social worker to assist people to re-establish themselves in the community. You have thought it through and have family support. There will be some that don't have that, and that may have put them off doing the regeneration regime, said Nim. We're all interdependent in this world. I think we've talked about the interdependence a little bit, and the idea of this would cause a huge shift in the way things are run. I mean, I could even the aged care industry is a massively huge employer of people, and there's a lot of money involved in that. So there's all of that, and there's also the whole idea of the inheritance, isn't there? You know, so younger generations kind of, although I suppose that's tended to be of a quite a middle class concept, the idea that one will inherit from their parents.
Yes, that's true.
So.
Yeah, maybe we read just a little bit more and then we'll explore that because they do talk a little bit about some of those things.
Okay.
Yeah.
Another thing that my family considered as well, continued Heaven, is what happens to those people who don't have the financial resources that we have. My son looked into that 18 months ago and found a group who were advocating for a universal basic income that supports people with a baseline income for food and housing. It becomes a bit like a material right to live, and then people have their job income above that. Many places around the world have been implementing this with a lot of good results for the people. He researched it enough to go and see some politicians, as did many others in the group. And then about 10 months ago, some studies have begun with the universal basic income in Australia. That is probably one of the economic strategies that you were referring to the other day. So I think maybe talk about the universal basic income at this point.
I just want to make the point before we talk about that, that you quite rightly said about there's a huge societal financial investment in aged care, you know, people's jobs, all of that sort of thing. So that's got to, you know, be completely renegotiated, and the caring industry will go through a lot of retraining, because what we'll do is we'll have carers that are trained in a lot of these basic things that can actually start to train their residents and so on. So but what it will do is open up a lot more creative thought around people's jobs, because, I mean, I visited these places when I was a GP, and they're not the happiest places. I mean, the staff do their best, but, and, you know, the carers that I've met, it's so different to looking after young children, where they're growing and changing and creating life. It can be quite depressing even for the carers. They get close to somebody and then they die, you know, and it's all they're seeing them become more ill all the time. So this gives a whole, once again, a whole different flavour to carers, you know, and to the what it means to care for seniors. So that's exciting in itself, I think.
Yes,
I mean, this might be a bit further down the track, but this is part of the vision of the whole thing. Yeah.
Well, there's even now, I guess, with that, there's a potential, or I think once people become aware of how, like the Rachel Wu study of how important it is to remain creative and to learn new things.
Cognitively engaged. Yeah,
so even with people who already have some cognitive deficits to sort of maintain what they have and to try and build on that rather than expect that it's all going to be downhill, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, over time the carers themselves can retrain in other areas. Mm. If something like a universal basic income came in, they would have plenty of time to retrain. They might create their own businesses. Mm. Who knows? I mean, it opens a door for lots of different options for people. So I think that carers would rejoice themselves with the new steps.
Mm.
And the government then could start to, well, obviously for a while they'll have to use that money to facilitate people returning to the real world and so on. But in time, it would mean that a lot of those, that money is used in such a different way and a much more life-affirming way.
Yes.
So, yeah, the idea of the universal basic income is that, yeah, the governments just give a baseline income, a bit like what we have with Centrelink at the moment if people are unemployed, but that it gets given to everybody and it covers the necessities, food and shelter and a bit of clothing. So that means that that is a firm platform off which people can then live their lives and do their work, part-time or full-time or whatever. So it doesn't mean they stop working. Some might take a break for a month or two or retrain in some way, but it just offers so much more flexibility. And I think, and public health studies now are coming through. I read one recently from the UK from professors of public health and all of these areas, human health and sociology and all that, that are saying that there's a lot of evidence to show that this will be huge for health, a universal basic income. And many, many studies are being conducted around the world that are showing very good results. And it's not a disincentive to work. In fact, it's the opposite. People generally are working more who are receiving the UBI, because one thing that happens is they get out of that stress cycle.
I think that's absolutely true in terms of, I've worked in the employment industry as a psychologist, and a lot of times it's the people who are under the most stress that find it the hardest. And as pressure is increased on people to apply for more and more jobs, even though the jobs aren't necessarily there, they become even less able to actually secure employment. So it's I think there is something to do with having enough kind of breathing space in order to be able to work, you know,
many economists around the world now are saying that we can do it in Western countries for sure. And it's only a matter of time that if we work out a formula, then that will be worldwide, and I think that would be huge.
Yes.
And
what about funding it? How? Because I know a lot of people will say, "Well, yes, that's all very well, but how? Where's the money coming from?"
Yeah, I'm not an economist. All I will say is, do your own research. And there are our people in Australia at Macquarie University, Sydney University, and so on, economists that are saying that we can. And they've worked out an economic system, and also this public health document from the UK gave several economic models. And that's as much detail I'll give on the economics, because I do not claim to be an economist.
Well, I can imagine that if it stopped a few wars, then that could save an awful lot of money for a starting point, you know, because if people are feeling, if there's less poverty and economic inequality, then less likely to having to spend huge amounts on that.
Yeah, and once again, it's a shift in consciousness that needs to occur.
It is.
You know, rather, and that's a whole different, it's really another topic for a podcast that I can't really do, but it is an economic framework that is being looked at very seriously, and there are other models, you know, so it's that thing. Humans have the creative ability to solve these things.
Yes.
If we have the right intent, if our intent is love and caring and connection and, you know, that we are one organism on this planet and we are interconnected with nature and that we can work it out. Yeah.
I think the intent has to be there first, and I suppose part of the idea of these conversations is to enable people to at least begin to entertain the possibility of this. And I think as more people entertain the possibility of it, it becomes more likely, you know.
Yeah, and I've certainly seen that in the last 30 years. As I said last podcast, there was virtually nobody saying anything about anything, and particularly not in the scientific world when I first felt that this was a possibility. And now it's like it's everywhere. Yes. And, of course, we now have the internet too, which it's very easy to see it all.
It is, and I think it's probably something, you know, if people are interested, just put in some searches into YouTube for you know, longevity,
healthy life extension,
life extension, and so on, and you'll find that there are there are a lot of studies going on around the world that are looking at these things.
And we've had a couple of people worldwide stand for Parliament. Yes. There was a Cambridge professor that stood. I don't know that he got in, but he stood, and another activist, he wasn't a professor, but he was an activist, stood for a presidential campaign in the USA. That was about 4 years ago. So, you know, to get to the point where you're putting a political candidate forward,
yes,
there's a lot of energy in this now, and it's like, let's have a real close look at it, because I can see huge advantages to the whole longevity, healthy longevity equation, not just for seniors, but for everybody.
And, you know, just while we're on the economic thing and the political thing, and one of the ideas is, provide an education system or a course where people can learn some of the strategies that are already well established. And to actually start to implement those into their lives.
Yeah.
From an economic point of view, in terms of the health system and what the savings in the health system could be,
huge.
It would be because it's really in the last years of life that the most of the spending tends to happen, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And if we can, you know, just really make a big difference there, that's huge. And the amount of money that the government would need to input would be so minuscule in comparison.
Yes.
You know, my model, my thought is like an 18-month thing, like Rachel Wu did, teaching them these cornerstones for health, which are, because some people may not have listened to the podcast, are last time's podcast, the meditation, mindfulness, emotional literacy, 80% plant-based whole foods, light exercise, music and simple music making, and learning a couple of tasks simultaneously. And that done part-time over 18 months, which would include social engagement, I think that would be so big a result for quality of life, for better health strategies, but also taught under the umbrella of the concept of focusing on the science of regeneration, and that there are all these mechanisms to regenerate the body and to not get your thinking into degeneration.
Yes.
And I could see ongoing social groups occurring as a spin-off from this 18-month course, which would just have amazing flow-on effects for people coming together with that different mindset.
Yes,
so the government puts in the first 18 months in a community centre or whatever, and then it just spins off from that.
Yeah.
And that is a minimal expense when we compare to what it costs for all those disease interventions in the hospital. Yeah.
Well, I think we maybe ended at that point for today. I think we've sort of we've explored a lot here. So
yeah,
We will be meeting again to talk probably a bit more about more of the spiritual aspects of this too, because that's an area that's of interest to you in your looking at how that research has actually impacted on people's longevities as well.
Yeah, and I think the other thing for people to realise is that most people, as they go through life, the longer they've been here, the more they start to think about themselves in a, you know, that idea of what happens when I do die. Mm. So it's an area that needs to be looked at and encompassed into what we're talking about, because it is a very interesting field that's even becoming scientifically researched in places like the University of Virginia that has the Department of Perceptual Studies. It's incredibly interesting, and that's really where I started because there was no science and I had to start looking at spiritual traditions. So I found that incredibly interesting.
Yeah. No, that sounds wonderful. Well, thank you, Jenny. Thanks for being again part of the podcast, and we'll end it.
Thanks, Iris.